Welcome to the Next Regeneration Podcast by the Osteology Foundation. We feature hot topics and novel perspectives, always with relevance to the dental career and practice. Join our hosts, Anina and Elena, as they speak with new guests from around the world each month and learn more about what's important for the next generation in oral regeneration.
Hello, everybody. And welcome back to a new episode of the Next Regeneration podcast. So the topic that we would like to address today is evidence-based dentistry. We often hear this term and we read about the importance to provide treatments that are supported by the most recent good quality evidence. However, maybe not all of us know exactly what we mean when we talk about evidence-based dentistry, also where to look for the best level of evidence, or more importantly, how to implement this approach into clinical practice. As such, we have invited today an expert that will be able to share her expertise and knowledge on this topic and also to dispel any doubts we have on evidence-based dentistry. Right, Anina?
Yes, exactly, Elena. Today, we are extremely happy to have with us Professor Elena Piquero, who is one of the most renowned experts when it comes to research methodology and evidence-based dentistry. Elena is a full professor in periodontology at the University Complutense of Madrid, where she teaches on the degree in dentistry, the EFP recognized master's degree in periodontology, and the Master of Science degree. In this center, she is also the Associate Dean for Quality Assurance and International Relations and the Director of Postgraduate Program on the Research Methodology in Dentistry, which is held in agreement with the Spanish Society of Periodontology. A warm welcome, Elena, to our podcast today.
Dear Elena and Anina, thank you very much for your warm welcome. It's my pleasure to be here with you today.
Okay, great, Elena. So thank you very much for joining us. It is always a big pleasure to talk to you. So I think before we start going into more details, I believe it's important that we firstly define what we mean for evidence-based dentistry so that we all are on the same page. So can you give us like quickly, you know, a definition of what we mean for evidence-based dentistry?
Okay, Elena, this is an interesting question to start with. So evidence-based dentistry can be defined as the combination of three items. So the experience of the professional, the patient's preference, and the best available scientific evidence. Therefore, this evidence-based approach in the practice of dentistry implies that we have the responsibility to ensure that the basis for therapy reflects the best available evidence, but it should be applied in accordance with the clinical expertise of the dentist and the wishes of the patient. This is really, really important. So it's not only science, it's also skills, and it's also patient's preferences.
Thank you so much, Elena, for the introduction and also the short definition about evidence-based dentistry. I do have another question. Which sources should be used to make sure that the an evidence-based approach. So what kind of resources should we follow and what is important? Does it, for example, mean that we only need to look at RCTs, like randomized clinical trials? And how do we select these sources and which kind of trust should we give to these resources?
Okay. So let's start with the first part of the question. So I will select two clear sources for the information. First of all, articles published in highly impact journals, such as the ones included in the Journal of Citation Reports, JCR, as it is commonly known. And second one will be the meetings, let's say, either attending plenary sessions in meetings or research session. So it is clear that the primary sources which should always be the publication in journals. But some months later, the same information that was published in the journals will be disseminated in meetings. So therefore, the origin of the information will be the same. But the thing is how to approach it. Regarding your second question, so should we rely only on randomized clinical trials? Okay, this is really important to be focused on because there are different study designs and we really need to choose the best one to focus on. So as you may know, there are two main types of study designs are the primary studies or secondary studies, usually known as reviews. So in terms of original studies, they are usually classified depending on the target populations. So when we are dealing with cells, materials, or tissues, we will talk about preclinical in vitro studies, which are usually called lab studies. They are usually considered to be really easy to do. So there are many of them, but they consider it, well, considering the grade of evidence, they are at the bottom of the scale. So one step above will have the preclinical in vivo studies, because the other one were in vitro studies. So in the preclinical in vivo studies, which are usually called animal studies, they are usually used to generate proof of principles or new hypotheses, but whose their results cannot be directly extrapolated into humans. So we need to go one step further. So let's think that we do not only have randomized clinical trials. So for this step further, we'll have human clinical studies, and these can be divided into observational studies, for example, cross-sectional, cohort, or case-control studies, or interventional studies. So the randomized controlled clinical trial will be one of those interventional studies. And this is considered to be the one with the highest grade of evidence. But this does not mean that we should not only read randomized clinical trials. This means that depending on the aspect we want to analyze, we will need to select the study type. Because if there has not been any publication regarding, for example, a technology firstly published, then we'll never go for a randomized clinical trial, but we will start with a cross-sectional study or even a preclinical study. And additionally, the word randomized clinical trial doesn't mean high quality always. So depending on how the randomized clinical trial was done, then it will have more or less biased. And on top of the randomized clinical trials, we also have, regarding evidence-based dentistry, these secondary studies, which are the systematic reviews in which we will integrate all the information coming from a specific topic. That would be great because they will identify the quality of the evidence, the anti-gaps of the knowledge, which is really, really important. So there was a time where systematic reviews were considered to be at the peak of the pyramid of the evidence. But nowadays, I will say that in 2016, the great approach changed and they decided to consider the systematic reviews just as a magnifying glass, so as a tool to evaluate all the other study designs. So we will need to pay attention to this because we really need to focus on what we need to study and select the best study design depending on what we want to do, but always considering the different steps of this truncated pyramid as it is considered now. Well, maybe I have to extend it a lot in my answer, but I have so many information to give you. Just let me know your opinion about it.
No, it's perfect. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I think you gave a great explanation and very clear about the pyramid of evidence. So I think this is very helpful because sometimes there is a lot of, you know, misinformation about this. So I think it was very helpful and you gave really a clear explanation.
Okay, thank you.
And you know, Elena, sometimes when clinicians hear about evidence-based practice, mm-hmm. they have this wrong, let's say, misconception that it follows a cookbook, if you know what I mean, you know, a cookbook approach to apply evidence into practice and that it does not leave room for flexibility. So how do we avoid that? I mean, I know you explained it when you told us in the beginning about the definition of evidence-based dentistry, but can you maybe better explain us how clinical expertise and patient preferences and needs and clinician skills are taken into account? Because really, you know, all of these ingredients should be considered when we treat patients, obviously.
Oh, of course, because we cannot treat patients only with publications. Of course, we need much more than that. So let's try to go back to the definition and to go back to the to say that evidence-based dentistry consists mainly on three pillars. So each one will need a specific approach. So first of all, and I would say it's one of the most important ones, we need to have enough clinical skills to perform dental procedures. And sometimes we forget about it, but we are taught how to perform our procedures during the degree of dentistry, but we cannot stop there. So evidence-based dentistry also implies that we need to be updated. So either we need to go for a postgraduate program in order to be proficient at a specific aspect on dentistry, or later on, we can also be updated by attending a specific hands-on courses with continuous education. So we cannot rely only on what we studied when we did our dentist degree. So this is also evidence-based dentistry. We need to be updated. We need to have enough clinical skills. And that is not only treat patient, it's also attending a specific courses to be updated according to the nowadays technologies. So that would be the first pillar. And I think it's something important, and sometimes we forget that this is evidence-based dentistry. The second pillar, that will be the patient preference. This, I guess, we do always in our everyday clinical practice. So we need to listen into our patients. We need to incorporate their preferences to the final decision when making our treatment planning. Let's say we cannot say to the patient that this is the only option of therapy, but we need to offer them different options for therapy, both of them that we can perform because we have attended a specific course that really relies on, we rely on what we can do with them. But then the patient needs can decide which will be the best, the one that fits best with him or with her. And I think that's important. I think more or less this is usually done with the new generation. I wouldn't say the same for the old generation of dentists, which were used to a different approach. But in our generation, I will say that is more or less what we did. And the third pillar would be the best available evidence. And this is what sometimes gets into problems in some meds, in some clinical practices. And I say that for this, in order to be updated regarding the best available evidence, we need to think about reading publications from journals in our fields or attending conferences. And then we need to apply what we have learned by reading those manuscripts or by attending conferences into our everyday clinics. Specifically in our field in periodontology and implant dentistry, nowadays we have the opportunity to have clinical guidelines and consensus report. And these are specific publications written by experts in the field. So they are based on systematic reviews, but they show us the specific steps that need to be followed when treating a patient, but having some flexibility to incorporate also patient preferences. So it would be a good advice, at least in our field, to follow these specific guidelines that helps us to add the evidence-based dentistry into the everyday clinical practice. But we can never forget the three pillars. So we need to get the skill, we need to hear our patients, and of course, we need to read. But what to read, at least the clinical guidelines.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Elena, following up what you already said, which do you think are the main barriers that can be responsible of the gap between evidence and healthcare practice? And also, do you think there is a different approach towards evidence-based dentistry in the new generation? You already said it in a way. And compared to the old generation, maybe you can also explain a bit more.
Yeah, well, I will try. Not so easy question, but well, I feel that the main barrier are the time limitations we might have as clinicians. So we need to consider that after a long day working with patients, it's not easy to sit in front of a publication and start reading it. Because the problem is that there are so many publications that we are even intoxicated. That means we are intoxicated by information. So in this sense, selecting specific items will help us. For example, reading, as I said before, consensus report or clinical guidelines developed by recognized specific societies or attending their meetings, as I already commented before, because the time is a really problem that I think all as a clinicians can't experience in our everyday. But anyway, being updated is not an issue of generation, as in, in the old generation, there were not such a big incremental exposure to evidence. I would say there were less journals, less meetings, but the access to them was more difficult. You need to go on site to a meeting, not online, and everything was on paper. For the new generation, with the online content and the dissemination of information through social media, it seems to be easier to be updated. But the truth is now the amount of provided information is so large that we really need to be strict with ourselves and decide in advance the sources of information we will rely upon. So as I mentioned before, once again, journals including in Journal of Citation Report or meetings organized by official societies or foundations, which really give us a good background on what we need or to read about, to be updated about. So I'm not sure whether I have answered you or not, but I've tried my best.
Yeah, you did. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and you know, Elena, while listening to you, I'm really amazed by the level, you know, of knowledge you have on research methodology. You really can feel, you know, that this has been something you have dedicated a lot of time to. So I'm a little bit curious how, you know, your interest in research methodology started. So what brought you to explore this field? Because it's a bit unusual in a way, you know, we are dentists, most of the time we dedicate our time to clinics. So how did it happen that you became so involved in research methodology in particular?
Okay, this is a funny story. I will say long and short story at the same time. So let me explain it to you. So since I was a child, I have always wanted to achieve a PhD, as my father was a doctor in chemistry and I have always been surrounded by research. So therefore, I knew I wanted to be a researcher before even knowing I wanted to be a dentist, which is not...
It's amazing.
Not usual at all. I know it. So therefore, when I finished my degree, I decided to perform my Master of Science and the doctorate in dentistry, and I got a full-time scholarship for doing it. So that was 4 years. So for doing my PhD, I was assigned a topic of periodontal diseases and pregnancy. So my interest in periodontology started after starting the research on the topic. So once again, research guided my decision. It's not that I started pregnant and I did my PhD, no. First, I started my PhD and then I fall in love with period.
Wow. I mean, you knew about PhD when we were playing with dolls. You knew already.
Well, not that much, please. I'm not also a scientist. I'm also a person. But let's see that research has guided lots of my decisions because I didn't know I'd like it so much, but it's true. So after finishing my PhD, I entered a 3-year program on periodontology. And after finishing it, the program director, Professor Mariano Sanz, suggested me to get better trained in research methodology and statistics. So I performed 4 years postgraduate programs only dedicated to research methodology and on health science in general, not in dentistry. I did that in Barcelona, here in Spain. And since that, I never stopped not only doing research, but teaching research. And that, I think, it makes a difference because once you need to explain it, something which is not so common among dentists, as you have just said, Elena, that gives you a big opportunity to learn. So when you teach research methodology, you also learn how to explain it. And that opens your mind. I don't know how to explain it in a better way, but research has always been important for me, and I think it opened me a lot of opportunities in my life. So I'm really thankful for that.
No, it's really impressive, and I really feel your passion about research methodology. I think that's the key component. When you do something with passion, then it just goes out so easily. I think, and you became also an expert in research methodology. So. And you have also been involved in different consensus conferences. in the past year. So it's very, very interesting. And this includes also the joint EFP and osteology workshop on bone regeneration in 2018. And then also the joint consensus on peri-implant soft tissue in 2022. And the most recent EFP consensus conference on the stage 3 level clinical practice guidelines for periodontal and peri-implant diseases. In particular, the stage 3 level clinical practice guidelines are real milestones in terms of evidence-based dentistry, I would say. Can you tell us maybe a bit more about the work behind the scenes and maybe also how does a consensus meeting work? Because that's normally okay. We cannot really see and hear and know.
Okay, I will try. I will try to summarize all the steps, which are, let's say, quite of them. So let's just start with the beginning. So let's say that everything has started when the scientific committee of the workshop identifies the topic of the workshop and the list of items that will be reviewed. So once the list of topics is clear, then this scientific committee selects reviewers, usually two per topic, and all of them to prepare a systematic review on the topic. So there are some rare cases where narrative reviews are accepted, but it's not usually the case. So as a reviewer, you have in between 6 to 9 months to perform this invited systematic review. So 1 month before the on-site workshop, the systematic review should be ready, and the manuscript should be sent to the selected journal for peer review process. And this is really important. This peer review process is totally independent from the workshop. So in order to assure the quality, so we really need that the evidence is independent from what reviewers, so from what participants has wrote. So in my case, for that, I have worked with Journal of Clinical Periodontology, Journal of Periodontology, and Clinical Oral Implant Research. So depending on the specific workshop, the journal is selected. It's not you selected, it's the scientific committee, the one who selected. So at this stage, so the manuscript is finished and it is supposed to be sent to the journal. There's also an online meeting. And this usually takes place more or less 1 month before the workshops. And during this online workshop or online meeting, important clinical questions are identified, because up to this moment, we had been talking when we have been working with systematic reviews, and this deals mainly with evidence. But during this online meeting, the clinical questions that are coming from all the reviewers or participants are mainly related to a clinical question that you usually will arise from the everyday clinical practice. So once the questions are identified, we just move to the on-site workshop. And during the workshop, there are three people participating there. These are the chairman, the reviewers, the one who prepared the systematic review, but also participants. So the participants are experts in the topic, but that were not involved in the systematic review, once again, to ensure the quality of the answers. So during the workshops, all three types of person, reviewers, chairman and participants, elaborate the answer to each specific clinical question that was prepared 1 month ago, more or less. In the case these workshops are clinical guidelines, then also stakeholders need to take part of the discussions or in the discussions, and each answer needs to be formulated in a very specific way. So this is the main difference between a consensus report, normal one, and a clinical guideline. In the consensus report, you can answer the question the way you want, but in the consensus, in the clinical guidelines, you need to use a specific frame. There are three frames depending on the evidence. So if there's a lot of evidence, that would be grade A recommendation, and then should be the answer should start by it is recommended or not recommended. If there is not so much evidence, that would be grade B, and then it will be written as it is suggested or not suggested. And in case there is not enough evidence, that is an open recommendation, and that will be written as it may be considered. So that is the reason why all clinical guidelines always start in the same manner, because you need to follow that specific pattern for a clinical guidelines, which does not occur in a consensus report. In case these are the clinical guidelines also, they need its question or its answer, in this case, needs to be voted. And the consensus among participants needs also to be written in their manuscript. And of course, then they will need to be distributed, because once again, we do these clinical practice guidelines to modify or to improve the quality of our everyday clinical practice. So if we do not distribute it just by podcast or by, for example, meetings or any other way you might imagine, then there will not change our clinical practice procedures. So that's the last part of a clinical guideline or of a consensus report. And I think it's one of the most important items. So I'm really in favor of trying to promote as much as possible this distribution of the information in order, not the ones that were involved, but every dentist will try to follow the guidelines that are really published in the literature. So I think it's more or less that is. So a lot of steps, but I tried to summarize them in a better, in the best way that I could. I hope it helps.
You did, yeah. Absolutely. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Elena. I mean, thank you very much for sharing your expertise and knowledge on this complex topic with us. You know, when we talk about research methodology, I always have the feeling that it's a bit of a dry topic and difficult to deliver to a wide audience. But I must say that through your words, we really could feel your passion and dedication for research. And you were really able to make a challenging topic like evidence-based dentistry as appealing. So thank you very much for that. And I'm sure that this talk will be of inspiration, not only for researchers, but also for clinicians that hopefully will look at evidence-based dentistry with different eyes from now onwards. So thank you very much for being with us today, Elena.
Oh, thank you very much. It has been really a pleasure being here today with you. I really enjoy, as you have seen, I'm passionate by both theory and research. So whenever I have to talk about it, I think it's a good time, moreover, if it's spent among friends. So I hope all of you will really enjoy just listening to us as much as we have enjoyed, working on it. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Also from my part, thank you very much. And I really enjoyed it. It was really interesting. And as Elena said, to make a dry topic very interesting, there must be passion with it. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anina.
Welcome to the Next Regeneration Podcast by the Osteology Foundation. We feature hot topics and novel perspectives, always with relevance to the dental career and practice. Join our hosts, Anina and Elena, they speak with new guests from around the world each month and learn more about what's important for the next generation in oral regeneration.